This episode is brought to you by Jacobson Salt Company, America's leading salt maker. Learn more at jacobsonsalt.com. That's jacobsensalt.com.
Now streaming from HRN, this is The Feed Feed. I'm Jay Cohen, editorial director of The Feed Feed, the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source of what to cook, bake, and drink. Occasionally joined by our co-founders, Julie and Dan Resnick, we sit down with leaders and upstarts of the food media realm.
So we often say that we're, as Feed Feed, answering this sort of age-old question, which is, what do we eat for fill-in-the-blank, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Our approach to doing so involves lifting up voices from culinary content creators all over the world, no matter how big or small their following is. This podcast takes the democratization of food media one step further by giving a behind-the-scenes look of the Epicurean magazines, websites, videos, and accounts you digest every day. We'll discuss everything from breaking into the industry, navigating social media.
That's been my bigger social media thing, is like, I think like I just get bored very quickly. And even when things are working really well, I'm like, everyone's doing this, I don't want to do this anymore.
Building and growing a community.
People are like, why is it five E's? And I'm like, I don't know, when you say eats, how many E's does that feel like it sounds like? And that's why. No real good rhyme or reason to any of it, but that's also kind of been our style this whole time.
And producing content that resonates with young and old.
You know, if someone doesn't like my writing or the photographs of my book or the design, that's subjective. But if I see that a recipe didn't work, then I really failed someone.
So whether you want to know what goes into food styling a magazine cover, the process of getting a cookbook deal, understanding what the hell TikTok is, or grasping how a recipe can go viral.
I mean, I guess the thing about going viral too is that then it's out there and people start claiming it as their own. And that's happened a few times recently with that tart, which is sort of depressing.
But... drag them. Name names.
I'm not naming any names, but you know who you are.
We'll be covering it all. This is the Feed Feed Podcast. Subscribe to the Feed Feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection between food and grief, with your hosts, Zara Tangora and Bobby Conforto. This week on the show, we are joined by Amelia Nirenberg, a journalist for the New York Times. She was kind enough to join us to talk about an amazing article that she wrote about widows and their experiences with cooking and food and eating and mealtime. We also just want to say this week and acknowledge that there was a great loss in the sports world and in the entertainment community of Kobe Bryant. And I think it really sent shockwaves through, you know, our kind of global community, because it's such a tragic thing when anyone passes expectedly or unexpectedly. And I think that there's something about our idols and people that we hold in esteem and people that we feel like have made it to a certain level and we admire them, that is just... It's a visible loss that we can all see and experience at one time. And it doesn't necessarily make the loss any more profound than any other human life, but it is something that we mourn as a community. And it forces us to all kind of think about our own situations and our own mortality. And it's very sad. And so we just want to acknowledge that and send our condolences out. And we hope that you enjoy this episode of Processing with Amelia Nirenberg. Thank you. Hello, Bobby.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you?
I'm really okay. Pretty good.
What's going
on? Well, I'm not going to get into the fact that I was at a funeral last week at this time, but that's true. My father-in-law died.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but other than that, I'm really good, and I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to see you. And we're joined today by an amazing guest, Amelia Nirenberg, who is the author of an amazing article that just came out in the New York Times that was sent around to both Bobby and I by various people. I think I got the article sent to me like 25 times, and it's an amazing article entitled
"For Many Widows, the Hardest Part is Mealtime."
Yes.
I think.
That is it. We've all been pondering, as though we don't have access to the internet, our own notes.
Right.
About the name in question. But I think, like, the name is actually the least important part. And the most important part was what the message of it was, which really is just exactly what we talk about on this show about, you know, truly the intersection of food and grief. And, you know, not that when we started this show that I thought in any way was food and grief some kind of new revelatory idea or concept, but the more that I've been thinking about it, the more I see it. Maybe it's like when you think, you know, the theory that when you think about things a lot, they cultivate.
Yeah,
and
yeah, you manifest them.
You manifest them, exactly. Yeah. So, but anyway, I was really... so excited to see this, and it was so beautiful and beautifully written and thoughtful and
very comprehensive. It really was a deep dive into the bereavement process, I see it too.
Yeah. So when we initially spoke the other day, I had so many questions for you just over the phone. I was getting so excited just chatting with you because I just feel like we're on the same wavelength about this. And, you know, can you tell me like a little bit about your like upbringing? Like, have you experienced a loss at some point along the way that made you think of this? Like what really led you to this point?
For sure. I grew up in New York, and when I started the job at the food section of the Times, was trying to think about stories that were food adjacent but not food direct, in part because I don't really have a culinary background. And was thinking, my grandparents were, if not my primary parents, at least my co-parents. Both my parents worked pretty crazy hours, and my granddad died when I was 7. Mm. And I was thinking about that. My grandmother's a huge cooking influence in my life. She was an amazing cook. And for a while after he died, she wasn't cooking very much. We weren't cooking that much together. And the foods that were in the house were basically kid friendly. Mm-hmm. And when I was thinking about food adjacent stories, I thought about that moment and just how hard it was for her to find joy in something that she had once really loved.
Yeah. Did you talk to your grandmother about that at the time? Or I'm not sure if she's still with us.
Yeah, yeah.
She is. Okay. Yeah. Did you speak with her like before you decided to write this article?
She actually suggested it.
Oh.
Yeah. We were talking about, I was saying, you know, I want to do, I'm thinking about stories, Nana, do you have any ideas? And she said, well, no one cooks after their husband dies.
Wow.
And a lot of her friends, she was one of the first people to lose a partner in her circle. Yeah. And it's been something she's noticed, and I've noticed with all of her friends, one after another, they just close up their kitchens for years.
Wow.
That's right.
Yeah.
A lot of it is not wanting to celebrate, really. It's hard to celebrate.
Exactly.
Totally.
And when people love food, it's part of their celebration of life.
Yeah.
I had a really interesting conversation with someone last night. I was chatting with a good friend of mine who is trying to get pregnant and not been able to. And we're the same age. I'm 35. She's 35. And I'm 35 and I'm single and can't seem to like get it together. I just can't seem to find the right man. But in all seriousness, like we were talking about how it can often feel like, you know, you're not part of a certain club, right? Like, so the club of like women in their 30s who have kids, or the club of men who want to be whatever, or any type of person who feels like they should be somewhere and they're not. And I actually kind of related that to the same thing about, you know, especially when you were just saying once the husband dies and like she was the first one in her group whose husband died, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, I'm not really part of this club anymore. So maybe I don't deserve to have this thing. You know, similarly, like I could just speak for myself, being someone who's single, feeling like, oh, well, I'm a single person, so I don't deserve to go out to dinner. I don't ascribe to this, but I'm just saying, like, you know, I don't deserve to go to dinner. Or I can't go to a movie because I'm a one, or I shouldn't do this. And I do all those things, of course. But, like, it's hard. And I think part of that with women or men or anyone who loses a partner or is widowed, it must feel a little bit, I would assume it kind of must feel a little bit like they are no longer part of something.
They feel like a fifth wheel. They often talk about going out to dinner being really hard, you know, feeling like the fifth wheel and who's going to pay the bill and conscious that other people want to treat them and they want to feel independent.
Right.
Yeah. And another thing is really, and I think you mentioned this in your article, is that if their partner isn't here, their spouse isn't here, then they feel like they don't deserve to do those things. Like if they enjoyed Japanese food together.
Right.
And they say, well, I don't want to do that anymore because now he can't do it or she can't do it. So I think that's another part of why they feel so left out of things.
Right. That was something that really surprised me in the conversations I had, mm-hmm. was how social this part of grief can be.
Yes.
Because, you know, you're a group of four couples, suddenly there are seven of you,
mm-hmm.
and the person that, you know, the other couples don't know if they're going to make them feel bad by inviting them. You don't want to go out and have to drive home alone from a favorite restaurant. One of the women I interviewed was this very good cookbook writer named Lori Burroughs Grad, and she said that she had been demoted to lunch, which I thought was good just point. Such a clear encapsulation of what it's like to be amputated from your social partner.
Yeah. A client told me recently that, you know, for her, she felt like it wasn't even lunch, it's coffee. You know, she said it makes it easier because then I don't have to think about any of the aspects of my past relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, eating has all kinds of different meanings to everybody. I think we'd like to tend to think that eating and cooking is joyful. And I think hopefully most of the time it is. And mm-hmm. if it's not like purely joyful for people, it's at least bonding, right? It's something that we can do either as a community or with a partner or with like your children or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like, I don't know, one of the things about grief when you lose someone, especially if it's that partner where you get to just unwind or celebrate with. It's so terrible to have that part of your life shaken up, right? And I think what was
It's everyday life.
Yeah. And it's so much more, what I thought was interesting about your article is just, it's one of those things, I think because we live in a culture where we don't talk that much about grief. And mm-hmm. I think we are starting to more and more.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not prepared for it. You're not prepared for it. You don't think about it because you don't want to think about it, right? Like you don't want to think about how is my everyday life going to be mixed up?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's one of those glaringly awful, unfair things about loss that just feels like, well, this too, you know what I mean? I have to be heartbroken all the time, but also now I can't even enjoy
things I used to
eating.
Be used to enjoy.
This is so fucked up. Like it's unfair. It's unfair.
Yeah.
And we don't like think about it a lot. So I really like, thought your article was wonderful and very important because it really like allows people to look at something that is important to face and useful to face mm-hmm. before you actually have to come to terms with that loss, because it can give you maybe a little bit of a chance to think about it and plan for it a little bit. Not that you can ever plan what your grief will look like, but I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we think about what grief looks like, a lot of people told me, I knew I was going to have to get rid of her clothes.
Mm.
I knew that I was going to have to re-record the voicemail. I knew that I was going to have to transfer the bills. And I think that those are the physical manifestations of sudden singleness.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was going to waste half the milk I used to buy. That's not something that you think about, in part because, mm-hmm. as you say, it's such a taboo.
Yeah.
And in part because there's this social alienation element of grief, no one tells anyone about what it's like. One of the grief counselors I spoke to said, you know, no, people are asking, are you sleeping? But no one's asking, are you eating?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so obvious, everyone eats, that you just don't, if it doesn't happen to you, you don't realize it's going to happen.
Totally.
I've run a lot of bereavement groups in my career. And one of the things we would always do is say, anybody cook for themselves this week? And when somebody would say, I made some salmon, we would all cheer because it had to do with self-care.
Yeah.
It had to, you know, and that's the part you deny yourself in a way when you have a loss of somebody you love, they abandon you and you abandon yourself.
Mm-hmm. And it's also just such a sensual thing. To eat, you have to be so present to your own body.
Yes.
And whatever your religious belief, when someone dies, they are not present to their own body anymore.
Mm, that's
so
right.
So taste, you can't salivate, you can't lick things off your fingers, you can't, you know, feel spice.
There are people that don't listen to music anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and for whatever period of time, or they don't go to a movie, or they don't want to enjoy life because their partner can't enjoy life.
Right.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a great quote that I have in my office. My office wall is filled with quotes because I feel like we've all going through this, so we have to share with each other the things that we learn. And the quote has to say, it says that time alone does not help us heal. It's the loyalty to life that helps us heal. And I think that's what you're talking about. It's being in all the aspects of life, including the pleasures of life.
Right. And I mean, when you're a couple, especially when you've been a couple for such a long time, especially if you're both aging and you're caring for each other, you share each other's bodies beyond from a sexual perspective.
Yeah.
But the care and the maintenance and the upkeep, you drive each other to doctor's appointments. And in that sharing, you're sharing food because you eat the same thing with someone every day, three times a day for 40 years.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, and suddenly you don't have that link to their body anymore. And it's just a lot of people talk to me about one woman talked to me about the intimacy of the inside of her mouth.
Mm.
She didn't want to go on the record. So it's not like
that's so deep.
But, yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mentioned that my father-in-law died this week and he was in hospice.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And it made me think, I worked in hospice for many years,
mm-hmm.
and I remember part of what happens is that when somebody is dying, they do stop eating.
Yes.
So I think for those spouses whose partners died through a long illness process,
mm-hmm.
that a connection to food has changed already. It's not just when they die. It was the whole process of their dying.
Of course.
And, you know, as their partner stops eating, and they try to feed them even when they can't eat because food is life. And
absolutely. And I actually wrote a piece that's coming out in a zine in the next couple months. And it was about feeding my father his last meal, which was a roast beef sandwich. And in the piece, I kind of wrote about how he had cancer for like 10 years and I would make him food all the time. I'd go down there. He lived in Nashville. I'd fill his freezer with different things.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was like, oh, well, as long as this person is eating, they're not going to die. So I'll make like a ton of food because there's no way he can die. I mean, and obviously that's just, you know, silly kind of fanciful logic. But like, you know, if there's a whole lasagna, he'll have to live 30 days because there's 30 slices to eat. And, you know, I think once you kind of see someone stop eating, it's definitely a huge signal that like, okay, well, this is actually really over. I can't keep doing this anymore. Yeah. Like, you know, and as long as they're eating, they're still alive. And as long as they're still alive, I'm not in pain. You know, it's really, it's really, really complicated. And
you did a lot of good research in your article. And I appreciated when you were interviewing one of the grief counselors who talked about the stages of grief and saying that it's really not used anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that. And I wanted to bring up the concept of the tasks of grief because I found them interwoven in your article all the way through. So I thought it would be helpful to bring them up because it was so much of what you spoke to and the people that you spoke to. So the tasks of grief have more to do with the work we have to do in the grieving process. And the first task is working on accepting the reality of the loss. And of course, grief isn't linear. So the whole time you're working on accepting the reality of the loss. Every time you go into a supermarket and every time you eat a meal and you're saying to yourself, he's really not here or she's really not here. So that process, that task of accepting the reality is in our everyday. The next task is managing the feelings. And I've had many clients tell me that they walk into a supermarket and they literally break down in the supermarket and nobody understands why. And they run from the supermarket and
everyone
leave there.
Everyone I interviewed said the exact same. Every single person.
Yeah. Really? Yeah, that's the supermarket. I mean,
it's so
hard. It's the minefield. You see something. One woman spoke to me about marshmallows. Her husband loved marshmallows. And she would do like crazy routes throughout the supermarket to avoid
to avoid
the marshmallow.
The marshmallow aisle. The triggers are everywhere.
Everywhere.
But remember, triggers are the things that help us accept the reality. So we try to avoid them, but they're actually things that help us along the process. So the next task is learning to live without that person in the world. And that's exactly what your article is about. You know, every time you sit down at the table and every time you think about anything, you're realizing they're not here. And how am I going to live without them? How am I going to make dinner without them? How am I going to have a dinner party without them? How am I going to go to a restaurant without them?
Yeah.
The next task is working through unresolved issues. And, you know, I think you mentioned one of the points in the article was when maybe you had a partner who didn't cook.
Yes.
Or you did all the cooking or whatever. And sometimes there's a resentment or a feeling of, let's say they did all the cooking, but you had all the recipes. You knew how to do everything. I think you mentioned a gentleman whose wife did all the cooking and he never did.
Yeah.
So sometimes there is that resentment that comes up too.
There's also one of the women I interviewed in the piece named Deborah Stevens lives in South Carolina and she's lost a lot of weight. I think she's lost over 70 pounds.
Yeah.
And something that she and I spoke about, which didn't make it into the article, was how she had been when her husband was alive. She had felt so guilty for being heavy. Mm. And now that she is thinner and feels more like the person she wanted to look like, how she feels all this resentment at herself for not having been able to deliver that version of herself to him. So too for a couple of people who have gained weight, where their husbands would always talk to them about how they were bony.
Right.
And suddenly they've, you know, they're stress eating and they look like the bodies that their partners had wanted and their partners aren't there for it.
That's so moving.
It is moving. And it's also, I don't know, it just reminds me how I, in my own kind of loss of someone important to me, I think a lot about how it's so hard to have this continuing relationship with a dead person.
Yes.
So what you're talking about is like, well, I would have been thinner for you, or I would have been heavier for you, and I'm so upset now that that can't happen anymore. That's still continuing this like negotiation and this relationship with someone who's gone, and it is so frustrating because you catch yourself sometimes realizing that you're having resentment towards them, you're having feelings of joy or regret, and it's so singular, whereas like the relationship doesn't exist anymore where you can say that and tell them, you know what I mean?
But so it's part of the healing process, and in therapy you help people continue those things that are unresolved and talk to them and write to them and have them write back and have them talk back. So you do continue that relationship.
But it is frustrating. Unless you really do get a handle on it, you like have someone to guide you through it, a therapist, or you do, you know, some investigation independently on that, it can be such a frustrating feeling. And it just really struck me to mention that when you're talking about these women feeling, you know, frustrated by now being what their partner had wanted in the past. And it's just like, it's so hard. That's another thing I think people just really don't talk about, and we don't know about grief, is having those relationships after death with people that can be just
absolutely
very frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, my grandfather loved burnt cookies. And for, I think whenever my mom makes cookies, she certainly did this when I was still living at home, but she would take most of them out and burn like two or three.
Love it.
Just kind of to do it. And it's, I mean, that's sort of a happy story, but two years ago, our closest family friend, the mom, committed suicide, and her daughter is, and I are very close, and she has just started cooking from her mother's recipe book. Wow. And it's this, it's one of the ways that she's been able to heal from the anger of her mom's death and she, you know, making this Christmas stew and making the Christmas cake and bringing that joy that they shared together back. But it's only two and a half years after that she's able to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It often takes that much time or longer.
Totally.
You know, the other thing, and I think of you, Zara, around this one, is that sometimes we're angry at our partner because they didn't take care of themselves. And maybe they overate.
My dad,
and that's what
more
brought
the
them
obese.
To
yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah. And I know you were very upset with your dad during that time.
Well, anger, I mean, anger after death is just—it's a hard thing to deal with. You know, I honestly think like the feelings when you think positively about someone after they've passed away, it makes you sad, right? You're like, I miss that. But I mean, it can make you happy and bring a smile to your face, but that is the thing that can hurt. Seeing something in the supermarket, you see the marshmallows, you think about your husband who loved them.
Right.
That is a positive memory in a way, but it makes you
bittersweet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anger with someone after they've passed because they didn't take care of themselves.
It's such a more living emotion.
It's so wild and it's so hard to know what to do with it. And and you're talking about grief not being linear. That's one of the things that I've noticed just in like certain times when, you know, you find, and I actually was struck by that when reading your article as well, because it's one of those things I had anger at my dad recently because I was dating somebody who I think thought that my grief was too much, and I felt angry with my dad. I'm like, God damn it. Now you're like ruining this relationship. And I was like, whoa, I feel so angry. And this is so weird. My dad died almost 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading your articles, like, I can really relate to this because I can imagine that a lot of these people who have lost people can end up feeling like, I used to like eating.
Right.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
Why did you have to die? Like, this used to be great for me, and now you're not here. And, you know, maybe it was completely unavoidable thing, as most death is, you know, but a lot of times it's not. Suicide or not taking care of yourself or being careless or, you know.
Car accident.
All these things. So, I mean, I think that I would imagine that a lot of these widowed people must feel at some point, whether they're able to admit it or not, or want to admit it, mm-hmm. and I guess that doesn't matter, but like there must be a bunch of anger.
It's interesting. There is, and I've spoken to a lot of people who are, I mean, the weight loss example is one, but one of the other things that was really surprising to me was I went to a cooking class in the Chicago suburbs, and it's for widows. It's amazing.
Yeah. Tell the audience more about that.
Yeah, it's called Culinary Grief Therapy. It's, yeah. I think, two or four years old, and it's part group discussion and therapy, part culinary grieving, where they will bring widows in and people who have lost parents and siblings, people who are grieving, to learn recipes that are simple and pretty straightforward that they can cook on their own. And it looks like a cooking class. It's in an industrial kitchen. Three or four people make a dish together, and then it's served buffet style, and people talk with each other. And a lot of the widows I spoke to in that group have become really, really close, shared by food, which is one of the most communal ways to make friends, and shared by grief, which is similarly incredibly bonding. And one of the things that a lot of the folks I spoke about was how they part of their eating and grieving process was helping them detach from parts of a relationship that were controlling, mm-hmm. where people would have the experience of going to the grocery store with a list and then stopping and thinking, I actually don't like sausage, or I actually don't like broccoli. Right. And I've been buying this for you for 35 years and eating it myself for 35 mm-hmm. years. And I never have to do that again.
Yeah.
That's the other task of grief. Who am I now?
Yeah.
Who am I now without you?
Yeah. And anger can be a pathway to that, Absolutely. As can be everything else.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Anger being a pathway to who am I now, right? Because
yeah,
even
absolutely.
In the best of relationships, yeah. even in the most wonderful, loving marriages that have been around forever, there's, of course, I mean, two human beings who are different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most marriage is complicated in some way.
And you compromise a lot, and you give up things about yourself, and you kind of somehow lend your identity so that you, in mm-hmm. a way, lose your identity to some degree,
yeah.
even though you find a new one.
Absolutely. Right. So, I mean, interestingly, I think finding your own identity again through food after a partner dies is an interesting task. Mm-hmm. Did you have any experience with talking to anyone about that specifically?
Yeah, I mean, the example that I just brought up, one of the women I spoke to who lives in South Carolina was saying, you know, I'm no longer Mrs. David Stevens. I'm Debbie Stevens. Right. I don't know who I am.
Yeah.
I didn't talk about that as directly with folks. I think that not through the lens of food, but more just we were two people who did things together.
Right.
And now I am someone doing them myself.
Sure.
And you bring up one of the most important things, which is that grief is a process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a linear process. It's not a process that has a beginning, middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
I think we grieve our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can be remarried to somebody and in a happy life, and all of a sudden feel something triggers you, and you're re-grieving. And it could be through food, certainly.
Yeah,
you're re-grieving.
Of course.
Again, because we all our losses kind of fall into the same well. And so I think, you know, whenever we experience a loss, we experience all the losses of our life.
Yes.
Yeah, that is very true.
This episode is brought to you by Jacobson Salt Company. Jacobson's flake and kosher sea salts have garnered worldwide favor for their beautiful presentation and pure taste. In addition to an extensive assortment of pure sea salts and infused sea salts, Jacobson Salt Company also produces a line of salty confections, honey, cocktail salts, seasonings, gift sets, and other pantry staples. Harvested from the cold, pristine waters of Neatarts Bay on the Oregon coast, Jacobson Salt Company is a favorite amongst professionals and home cooks alike. Founded in 2011, Jacobson Salt Company's mission is grounded in craftsmanship and community, maintaining the vision of providing the very best cooking ingredients, from hand-harvested sea salt to single-origin honey. More information on Jacobson Salt Company and their extensive line of products can be found at jacobsonsalt.com.
So I have a question for mm-hmm. you. Being someone who is a writer and an interested person as a journalist, I'm assuming you're a journalist because you're an interested human, you're interested in other humans. But what did you learn about, what did you take away from writing this that you didn't know before that you think is maybe the most valuable, or the several things, whatever that may be to you?
It's a great question. I think something that a maxim of my family is that everyone lives life in quiet desperation, which is maybe not such an uplifting maxim to think about, but moving through the world. But just the amount of people who, if I hadn't known they were grieving, I wouldn't know they were grieving, was astounding. And I think also the length of time that an emotion takes or a state of being can occupy. We have such a like get over it mentality, and I'm still close enough to college that my unit of time is the semester.
Yeah.
And it is it like people speak about their life in periods of 6 and 10 years. But I also think that it really unromanticized a lot of my perceptions about grief and grieving and love and loving, because I think that when someone in the immediacy after someone dies, which is mostly how I've interacted with grief, a funeral, a shiva, a wake,
right,
mourning process, people talk about like the shining golden memories, the time we went on the hike, she always had the laugh. Mm-hmm. And people tell someone's story through these like highly saturated anecdotal experiences. And so I think that the way that you're supposed to love, if you hear it only from like a eulogy perspective, is to gather as many like gorgeous memories as possible. So you have this little box of beautiful jewels that you can look out.
Yeah.
And I think what this article showed me is how, sure, the first initial shock months, you're thinking about your pearls, but after that, you're just thinking about breakfast and lunch and cars and bill. And I think that it reframed so much of what a relationship actually looks like, mm-hmm. and what it looks like. There's something like...
Yeah, there's an earthquake happening.
Yeah, the floor is shaking. But just like, you know, if you look at it from the daily perspective of grief, like it changes the way that I look at my partner in our own relationship. Not that I'm thinking about either of us dying anytime soon, but just, you know, it's really, really, really nice to wake up next to someone.
Yeah.
That's probably truer than like the time we went to Morocco, you know?
Absolutely.
Even though there's numbness and grief, there's also an intense awareness.
Yeah.
Do you feel like diving into the subject has like, will better prepare you for a time when grief will, you know, come upon, when you'll be faced with it? Like, do you feel like the fact that you've been able to kind of deep dive into this and speak to so many folks who have experienced this kind of specific loss, like, do you feel more prepared for tackling this specific angle of like, okay, well, I know that, you know, this can happen and I might be really, you know, triggered and tend to do that? Or do you, does that make sense?
It's in a roundabout way, absolutely. My grandma, as I mentioned, raised me alongside my parents, but raised me, and she's 87 and she's totally with it, but her health is the health of an 87-year-old. Mm-hmm. And part of what our relationship looks like right now is not really talking about it, but kind of talking about it, preparing for what happens after. It's a different, it's a, you know, dead, alive person relationship.
Yeah. Anticipatory grief.
Exactly. And I think that these conversations have really helped me know that it will be hard to make her recipes for a while.
Yeah.
And it will be hard to celebrate holidays with her for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, any conversation about grief, I think, prepares everyone for grief, because there are so few conversations about grief. It's why I think that what you guys are doing is so important.
You actually mentioned, it reminds me of something you mentioned about the woman who went out to eat at a restaurant on the anniversary of her husband's death, and that she went out and had the same things that they had 50 years ago, I think it was.
A turkey BLT and a chocolate ice cream soda.
Yeah, I loved that.
That was so lovely. And it reminded me about the concept of rituals, and that rituals are the things that help us get through those difficult moments.
Yeah.
What you're saying is, of course, there's going to be these moments that they're so hard to get through, but the rituals we create help us.
Yeah.
I knew somebody that brought her husband's picture with her out to eat
And she put it,
and
on,
she
the
put
table.
It on the table. Yeah. And certainly lighting candles at the table. And when people have dinner parties, whether it be a dinner party for Thanksgiving or other holidays, they always question, what am I going to do with the empty seat? Like the empty seat is really a big deal. Yeah. And so the rituals that we create are very important for that, whether we make their favorite foods, as we talked about, or whether we do something in the process of eating that brings that person with to the table.
Yeah. My family is Jewish, and I'm not observant. But I have always found it really moving that you say the Kaddish three times a day. And the Kaddish is the mourner's prayer.
Yeah.
And you say it for, I think, 10 months. And the idea of three times a day that you say it, I mean, you say it with a meal.
Yeah.
And it is because, like, it is the moment when you are probably in touch most with your life force or your own body. Mm-hmm. And in that kind of try ritual.
Yes.
You are in touch with theirs, too.
It's really special.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that you mentioned in your article had to do something about sudden loss, and how that's very little bit different. Remind me again what you had said, the story that you told about sudden loss.
Yeah, there's an artist named Jean Heifetz, and her late husband, Yuri Yurovich, was a writer and has actually a book coming out, and he died really suddenly. I think I don't remember if he had a heart attack, but he was there and then he wasn't.
Right.
And she actually, because they weren't preparing for his death, they had he was from Latvia, and they had Latvian bread in their freezer and a bag of grapes that he was going to have for dessert that night.
Yeah.
And he died last November, and they're still in her fridge.
Yeah.
And I think that she said it was like Pompeii.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah. And I think that is another element of this, because when someone, like as we were speaking about earlier, when someone's in hospice, they stop eating.
Yeah.
If you're living together, your fridge empties.
Right.
Their physical presence in your house drains.
Things are changing.
But, I mean, it's what Joan Didion talked about. She comes home after John Donne dies, and I think his scotch is still on the table, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That I love that. I have so many quotes from that book.
And people
in my notes right here.
People leave it that way.
The kanji.
Oh my God, the kanji. But it's soft and warm, and kanji, you read the Year of Mouth.
Yes, of course.
It's soft, and it's something that, like, well, actually, that's another.
It's baby food.
It's baby food. Yeah. I always eat kanji when I need. I'm not someone who really, if I'm in a bad way, I usually don't eat. I'm more of the, like, tequila and cigarettes diet kind of person. But kanji, I do
not
make an exception.
Food. Yeah.
No, I love it. It's so warm and so nice. Yeah. And she actually, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Bobby, but when she talks about that and about, like, her friend just bringing her something, you know, like, you need to eat, like, that really just struck me, because you will, in that kind of time, in that kind of shock and crazy, like, how did this just happen time, just not be able to think of nourishing yourself. And it is lovely for people to bring things to you.
Yeah.
Even if you don't necessarily need them, it's hard to know what to bring. You can't always nail it. Sometimes you're going to bring something that someone's going to throw in the garbage or let rot in their fridge, but who cares?
It's a way we can help people, for sure.
It's a kind gesture, because it helps to not have to think so much. You're already thinking
much. Yeah.
Yeah. When my grandfather died, Jews bring rugala, which are cookies that in my
Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
And my mom still can't eat rugala. It makes her too sad. But she will always be grateful to our friend Janet Spitzer, because she brought, like, a roast chicken from Key Food.
Right.
And I was 7, and I think I ate, like, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because no one had fed me.
Yeah,
know? And I think that bringing, like, don't forget to eat is what I tell anyone I know now that when someone dies. My cousin just died a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And it's been kind of the family's advice, just like, have you eaten? Did you eat?
It's really take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I want to go back to that Pompeii metaphor, because it's like frozen in time. And that's really what happens. And with a sudden loss, the trauma freezes us in time. So I love to tell the story. There was a movie in 2000 called Under the Sand with Charlotte Rampling. And it's a wonderful story about this woman who goes to the shore with her husband. It's part French. She goes to the shore with her husband, and she's lying down, asks him to put some lotion on her, and she falls asleep, and he goes into the water, and when she wakes up, he's gone. He's missing. So the amazing thing about this, it shows her a year of grief, and every night, and every morning, noon, and night, she wakes up, and she prepares the meal for both of them, and she sets the table for both of them. Mm-hmm. She serves the food for both of them. Mm-hmm. And she does this for a year, and her family and everybody around her are worried about her. They think that she's crazy.
Yeah.
But what the message of the movie is that she needs to do that. Just as the client, the person you were talking about, left the grapes in the refrigerator and the bread in the refrigerator, we need to do it for a period of time. She wasn't crazy. After a year, she stopped needing to do that.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, that's what she needed to do.
It's Kaddish.
It's true. And what I actually really liked about your article, and what I think maybe is the most valuable part of it, of the whole thing, which was extremely valuable,
thank you,
was the fact that it humanizes exactly what you're just talking about. It humanizes the insanity that you feel when you're in grief.
Right.
Right? So, your article wasn't an expose on, can you believe, of course not, but can you believe these people are
that grieving is hard?
Grieving is crazy. Look at this person.
10 ways grieving is hard.
Exactly. Yeah. Grieving stinks. No, but it really humanized it. And I think the takeaway, at least for me, and I think it, and for a lot of folks, was just that it's okay if you can't eat for a while, or if you lose a bunch of weight, or if you gain a bunch of weight, or if you bring your husband's picture out, or if you set the table for two people, or if all you can eat is congee, it's all really okay. And it's all really normal.
Everything is normal.
And that there may never be, you may never go back to square one. Right. And in fact, you definitely won't, because it's totally different, but you might eat popcorn for dinner for the rest of... Exactly. Yeah. You don't need to.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And it sucks. And it sucks to be a seventh wheel. And it sucks to not get to enjoy the things you used to be with your partner. And it sucks to break down in the supermarket. And it sucks to be in grief 10 years after your partner or your parent or your child dies. It sucks. But I think what the goal of this show, and I think something that I feel really passionately about, and I think you probably do too, is it can suck. And it can be awful, and it can be painful, and it can also be okay. And just because you've experienced a loss, and you're forever changed, and your habits change, and your eating habits change, and you feel pain, you can also be okay. And that's fine.
It's interesting. There's a concept in grief about that. It's called the dual model. And what it means is that we grieve and live at the same time.
Yes.
In the beginning, there's really just grief. But over time, little by little, we begin to grieve and live at the same time. We live with grief. Mm-hmm. That's what we like to do. Yeah.
But it really humanized, it really brought it to this really accessible way of looking at it being perfectly imperfect. And I really appreciated that about it.
Yeah, because you didn't just tell a story about people. You were part of it, and you could tell that.
You could really tell.
And also the fact that you interviewed so many people, it was so much about their stories. It wasn't about them. It was with them.
Yeah.
I really appreciated that.
That's incredibly kind. Thank you.
Yeah. It reminded me of another concept. The whole thought of the culinary program.
Mm-hmm.
Viktor Frankl, who's a very well-known writer and psychotherapist, he wrote A Man's Search for Meaning, and he was a Holocaust survivor. I quote him all the time. And he, while he was in concentration camp, he wrote a document. He obviously had no pen, so he wrote it in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some very important concepts in it. One of them was survival is a community event.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really what these workshops are about.
Yes.
So that together, and that's what support groups are about, together we can survive things that seem so impossible.
Yeah, and I mean, the line I ended the piece with is a paraphrase of something I heard so much that evening, which is you need to eat to live and you need to go on living.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
And you need each other to do it is, I guess, the third clause in that.
Yeah.
And, in some ways, the other thing Viktor Frankl talked about is meaning. And that's one of the other tasks of grief is finding new meaning, because in the beginning, you're not so sure you want to live.
Yeah.
So it over time, and people help you do this, you begin to find new meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, food, I know for us, food is part of the new meaning that we begin to find again. I have a client I recently worked with who I had suggested to her that it was really important to invite some friends over for dinner and to have a dinner party. It had been 2.5 years, I think, since her husband had died. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't imagine, because her refrigerator is empty now and she hasn't cooked in 2.5 years. But I said to her, it's going to bring life back into your house.
Yeah.
It's going to bring community back into your life.
Yeah.
So doing it in her house, she would go out to dinner with friends, but she would never have any friends come over.
Oh.
So making that dinner party, mm-hmm. and it was hard. She said, but we used to do this together, and he would help me do half. He'd set the table while I
right.
And so it was a process of her to do that, to try to do it all by herself. Yeah. But she did, and it helped her feel so much better.
That's great. This was an amazing conversation, and I just want to end with this very small Joan Didion quote that in the Year of Magical Thinking, she says, grief turns out to be a place none of us know until we reach it. And I think that was very evident in what you wrote and what, you know, I think a lot of people feel. You can anticipate it. You don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes it's a lot worse. Sometimes it's a lot easier. It really just is so unknown. And thank you for writing something that just helped making it. Yeah, that made it more bringing light to a really important topic.
And keep it up. Maybe we can do some other things together because you're interested in this and you're writing. You never know where
that would be so fun. Go.
Yeah, it'd be so cool.
Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Can you just tell the listeners where we can, if you have anything you want to plug, where we can find you?
I'm Amelia Nierenberg, and you can Google me with NY Times, and there I am.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Your writing is beautiful. I read a lot of your other pieces that you've written for the Times. I mean, I just have to say, I'm so impressed. You're a young woman and you have this amazing job writing for the New York Times. It's so impressive and so cool. And I just...
Thank you.
I obviously see you going so far in your career. It's so cool. It's so inspiring. It's really great. You know, it's really, really cool.
Sensitive and a lot of insight.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us.
You're the best.
Oh, my gosh. You're the best.
And what about that foie gras in New York?
Oh, my God. That's our next episode.
All right.
Thanks so much, Amelia.
Thank you.
Bobby, what an episode.
Oh.
What'd you think?
I was so moved because I work with bereaved spouses all the time.
Yeah.
And I thought that Amelia's writing of the article was fantastic. It was comprehensive. It was deep and sensitive. And for somebody that hadn't really been exposed to bereavement and bereaved widows, I think she did an incredible job.
I agree. Actually, that was my comment too, is that I kind of, you know, we are interviewing all different kinds of folks on this and with experiences from grief ranging to really intimate to looking at it to breakups to heartbreak to death to being in the emergency first responders field. So I really thought her take was very interesting as someone who was a researcher of grief. Not that she hadn't experienced any grief in her life, but being a researcher of grief in a way.
Well, it was also one of her first projects in researching grief.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. And I thought she was just really brilliant and very eloquent and very intelligent. And I have a lot of respect for people who are just intelligent in that way.
Absolutely.
You know, writers and readers and scholars and people who are, I don't know. I really liked her. I thought it was a great episode. So she talked about her grandfather loving burnt cookies. And so I kind of connected with that. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And it prompted me to do a little research about why people love burnt food. And so I started by researching something called the Maillard reaction. Now, Matt just told me when I was in here, I came in and I said, has anyone ever heard of the Maillard reaction? Because it's spelled M-A-L-L-I-A-R-D. And as some of you listeners might know, I've inherited a trait from my mom, which is called mispronunciation of
which
almost everything.
Which I inherited from my Yugoslavian mother.
Okay, well, you have a better excuse than I do. I think maybe I'm just lazy. So Matt says it's called Maillard, like my yard, but if you were a little bit drunk. So it's called the Maillard reaction, and it's named after a French chemist, Louise Camille Maillard, who first described it in 1912 while attempting to reproduce biological protein synthesis. In 1912, Maillard published a paper describing the reaction between amino acids and sugars at elevated temperatures. And in 1953, chemist John E. Hodge with the U.S. Department of Agriculture established a mechanism for the Maillard reaction. So basically, I'm gonna read a little bit of something from the Times and from Modernist Cuisine, but the Maillard reaction is basically what you get when you burn or char or sear or grill or caramelize any food, which is opposed to like boiling something, right? Or sous-viding it. It's when you're cooking something, how it basically caramelizes. So that means like burnt toast. That means a grilled steak. That means burnt sugar, making caramel, searing anything, you know, making a cinnamon bun and glazing the sugar. So that's a really enticing thing, obviously, about food. It's such a huge part of what becomes compelling about food, and it is more compelling for certain people than it is for others. Now, I also wanted to find out if this was something that certain people like for a certain reason. I think that's true. I couldn't find that, right? So, like, there's scientific evidence to support why certain people don't like cilantro, right? There's certain kinds of things that are really explainable. I couldn't find any research. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but in my research, I couldn't find anything that was concrete as to like why some people like these flavors more than others. Well, other than maybe it just being, you know, a familial thing, like, oh, my mom made this and so I like this. And
your grandmother, my mother, loved burnt toast.
Yeah.
And I grew up, I love burnt toast.
Yeah, so do I.
And my husband Rob is very conscious of things that he puts in his body, and yeah, he sees it as carbon, and he scrapes off every single bit. And I take the ends of the burnt toast, and that's my favorite part.
He scrapes his burnt onto every... your toast. He scrapes it when you put it in your coffee and stir it in.
Not exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I also love burnt toast because I remember that you like it and Grandma likes it.
I even like the smell.
Yeah, I like it too. I'm curious to why that is, but I like burnt things in general.
It's crispy.
It's also... here's the thing. It's also a richness of flavor, right? And so Rob, while he's an amazing person and definitely goes along with our culinary agenda, doesn't necessarily have this like innate familial, you know, he didn't come up with being like really enticed by like rich flavors.
Well, the intensity. It's not even just rich. You talk about the intensity of flavor, right?
And it's also has to just do with like, I don't know. I mean, I guess there's probably plenty of people who aren't super into food who like burnt toast too.
But it's also liking bitters in a drink. Some people, he doesn't like bitters.
Strong flavors.
Right.
And bitter, as a flavor is also a thing.
So I do think that there's tests that are done as to whether some people like, you know, sweet, sour, bitter, salty, you know, hot, spicy.
I like everything. I do. I like sweet. I like bitter. I like bittersweet. I like salty and sweet. I like really spicy. There's really no flavor that I don't like.
That's why you do what you do.
You don't really like spice, like hot and spicy, or it's just not... I know it's not great for your body, but
it's not great for my body, so I stopped. I'm not drawn to it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, so according to an article in Modernist Cuisine, the description of the Maillard reaction is a chemical reaction between amino acids and reducing sugars that gives browned food a distinctive flavor. What begins as a simple reaction between amino acids and sugar quickly becomes complicated. The molecules produced keep reacting in an ever more complex way that generate literally hundreds of various molecules. Most of these new molecules are produced in incredibly minute quantities, but that doesn't mean they're unimportant. The Maillard reaction, or its absence, distinguishes flavors of boiled, poached, or steamed food from the flavors of the same foods that have been grilled, roasted, or otherwise cooked at temperatures high enough to dehydrate the surface rapidly. High temperature cooking speeds up the Maillard reaction because heat both increases the rate of chemical reactions and accelerates the evaporation of water. As the food dries, concentration of reactant compound increases and the temperature climbs more rapidly. Concentration of flavor. Yeah, I just thought that was interesting. So again, that's from Modernist Cuisine, ripped from the headlines. That is a quote from them. Tejal Rao from The Times wrote an article called Charred, Browned, Blackened, The Lore of Burned Food. And it was a really interesting article, and they interviewed like a ton of different chefs in New York and out of New York about, you know, their cooking. One gentleman was making a mole and was explaining the importance of, you know, charring the ingredients in that. And in the article, it also did talk about the concerns associated with eating burnt food, which is carcinogens. And there's been a lot of talk of that. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of a person who lives my life generally in moderation. I don't go full on all the way with things, but I allow myself some things I know are bad for me sometimes because, A, I think it's kind of fine. And B, I don't know, it could all end at any minute. And I'm not trying to just prepare myself for the most perfect life ever. This is my one shot. So if I'm going to, you know what I mean?
Okay, go for it.
I think you're kind of the same way too. Burn it up. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So in the article, though, one thing that really stood out to me is that they interviewed a woman named Jennifer McGlan, and she's the author of a cookbook called Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor. And she developed a recipe for a toast soup based on a French country dish that stretches leftover bread into a meal. And I was so compelled by this recipe, I have to make it. And I'm not a recipe follower, you know that. I mean, I get inspired by foods and then want to make them. But this recipe sounded so incredible. I'm going to tell you what it is. So she starts with a version. So it's basically a burnt toast soup. So she starts with a bacon-infused chicken stock and then adds bread that's been carbonized and burnt. Not like totally burnt to a crisp where it's like a charcoal brick, but just burnt toast. And then she adds hot milk and mustard. So this is the actual recipe. It's bacon, chicken stock, sourdough bread that's been charred, hot milk, Dijon mustard, vinegar from a jar of cornichons, and butter. And it's basically all boiled together and then pureed. Doesn't that smell like the most delicious thing ever?
Well, I know
ever?
You like pickle soup, so I'm sure you were definitely attracted by
I love pickle soup. I mean, that's a whole nother episode. Pickle soup is delicious.
Right.
Have you ever had it? It has like sauerkraut and pickles and cream. Yeah. Oh my God, it's the most amazing thing ever.
So what are your favorite burnt foods?
Well, before the whole burnt carrot trend really took off, I'd say we were doing a lot of burnt foods at Percy. I mean, I love like roasted red peppers, which are a great ingredient. We used to do a lot of burnt carrots and a lot of burnt vegetables in general. I mean, we would do like burnt asparagus tartares. We would burn everything. And sometimes not on purpose.
Right.
I love burnt carrots. I really love grilled octopus. That's like a particular favorite flavor of mine, and grilled shrimp, like really charred shrimp. And you can kind of eat the head and the shell and all that.
Right. How about marshmallows?
I love marshmallows. I mean, that's
We could do an assessment whether who likes it burnt and who doesn't, because some people just very gently
those people
cook
are
it.
Not for me.
You gotta burn it and then rip that off and burn it again and rip it off. Of course.
I'm sorry. As you know, I'm currently, as we're recording this, single, and I'll know that like when I've met my perfect person. I could have met the perfect person. We could be like really happy and everything's going great. And then there are marshmallow.
It's a non-negotiable.
It's a non-negotiable because I know that means that person doesn't have the appropriate amount of zest for life. So just keep that. Anybody interested in dating me, just know they're going to have to burn your marshmallow. I eat like one marshmallow every 5 years. So I'm just kidding.
We are now sitting in the studio at Roberta's. And I'm sitting here staring at people eating wonderful pizza.
Yeah.
And the bottom of the pizza is slightly burnt.
Yeah. It's charred because they cook it in the hot oven. There's a lot of char. Totally. Pretzels are basically burnt. Like a soft pretzel, if you think about it. I mean, the outside is coated in lime, but it's so dark and so charred on the outside. That's almost like, that's a burnt flavor.
Well, in a box of crackers, we like to eat Vans. You know, these gluten-free crackers. I always look for the burnt ones. There's a few burnt ones.
Yeah.
And of course, Rob doesn't like those, so I get all the burnt.
That's perfect. You guys are made for each other.
I have a really good burnt story.
Oh, yes, please.
A great story.
Would love to.
So, as you know, before I was a bereavement psychotherapist, I was a chef, and I owned with your dad a business called Love and Oven. And, of course, over the holidays, it was a catering business, and we had a retail storefront. And during the holidays, we worked really, really hard. You know, as you can imagine, we had big orders going out, big weddings, and all kinds of things going on. So it came to New Year's, and we made all our New Year's Eve food, sent it out, and we went home, and we said, you know something, tomorrow's New Year's Day. Let's make a really beautiful roast, you know, gorgeous roast in the oven. Let's put it in. Let's take a little rest, have a glass of wine. So we put the roast in, had a glass of wine, and woke up 14 hours later.
No.
Well, I have to tell you, in the oven was this little teeny hard charcoal briquette. And it was a good representation of the food business, the food industry. Yeah. That's all we could do.
Totally.
That's the best we could do is make
Did
a
you
briquette.
Eat it?
No way. It was too burnt.
Too burnt even for you. That must have been pretty burnt.
Yeah.
All right, interesting. Well, yeah, that's a little bit about burnt food that I thought was kind of interesting. And again, Amelia was really just great. Such an interesting person, a young woman, and just so brilliant. I mentioned this on the show. I just really love to see people who are young and doing it and working hard and being so capable and smart. It makes me excited to see what else they'll do.
I was thinking the same thing. I'd like to follow her and see the other articles that she writes because she's very
she's
deep.
She's great. Yeah. An amazing, what an accomplishment to be a writer for the New York Times at, I don't know how old she is, but she seemed young to me, and I was just impressed. I would have been impressed with her at any age, but that just added to me to our cachet because it really gave me, I was excited about her future and about her current.
And Amelia, thank you so much for your generosity and sharing
really,
with us.
Really like an open person and an interested person, right? Like just, I think journalists in general though, right? That's the thing that makes journalists is that they are really interested in life and interested in other people's stories. As are we, and we share that, I guess, with her. So Amelia, thank you so much. Bobby, thank you. Should we go burn some food or eat some burnt
food? Let's eat some burnt food.
Okay. Perfect. Love ya.
Love you.
Bye. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.